you, Matthew Finch. Good afternoon. Welcome to Art Breaking. I'm Charlie Finch. Glad to have you with us. Before I introduce today's guest, John Davis, let's hear something from Marvin Gaye. My great pleasure to welcome back to Art Breaking, John Davis. John is the author of Kennedy's Dynasty and Disaster, which is just out recently from SPI in paperback. John is well known for being very generous to other JFK and RFK assassination scholars, and this book, Kennedy's Dynasty and Disaster, is about a complete version of the current assassination theories that you can find, as well as a whole history of the Kennedy family. John is also author of Mafia Kingfish, Carlos Marcello, and the Assassination of John F. Kennedy, out in a Signet paperback from New American Library. John, welcome.
Good to be back here, Charlie.
Now, John, it's been 6 months since Jack Newfield broke the Frank Regano revelations in the New York Post. Why don't you summarize those revelations for us again and tell us what progress has been made in bringing Regano before an official panel?
Okay. First of all, I want to express my own personal opinion that the allegation of Frank Regano made in January has to rank as one of the most potentially important revelations in the Kennedy assassination case and the whole history of the case. Well, it was in January that Frank Regano came out of retirement, so to speak. He had been an attorney for Jimmy Hoffa and Santos Straficante, and a friend, not a friend, but an associate, and someone who had dealings with Carlos Marcello. And he came forth and made the allegation that Jimmy Hoffa approached him in the summer of 1963 to bring a message down to Carlos Marcello, the boss of the Louisiana Mafia, and Santos Straficante, the boss of the Florida Mafia, formerly boss of the mob's operations in Havana, to the effect that it was about time that we got serious, that he wanted President Kennedy killed, and that they should go ahead with the job. Regano apparently met both Marcello and Traficante in a hotel in New Orleans, gave them this message, and had the feeling that they were both deadly serious about it. They took it very seriously, and that they had been plotting perhaps an assassination of the president on their own, even before Jimmy Hoffa contacted him on this. Well, as the allegation goes, Regano didn't have anything more to do with Marcello until after the assassination, or with Traficante about this issue. Right after the assassination, he had dinner with Traficante, and Traficante was beaming and just beside himself with joy, and proposed a toast in this small restaurant, I think in Tampa, Florida, to the assassination of the president. Now, we finally got rid of him, and he was just so happy. And Regano's 19-year-old girlfriend, who was in high school at the time, she's now his wife, was so horrified that she fled from the table and rushed out of the restaurant. I saw her, I met her recently, as I did Regano, and she rather convincingly told that story all over again. So then, after the assassination, Regano went to New Orleans to see Carlos Marcello, 3 or 4 weeks, I think, after the assassination. And he said he found Marcello looking like the cat that swallowed the canary, looking very pleased with himself. And he didn't go into any details of the assassination, but he said, "Listen, you go back to Jimmy and tell him that he owes me big now. He owes me big." And apparently Jimmy Hoffa had promised Marcello $3 million out of the Teamsters Central States Pension Fund if he went ahead with the job.
Frank Regano was also Santos Traficante's lawyer for 17 years, and Traficante made a deathbed allusion to the JFK and RFK assassinations. Tell us about that, John.
Yeah, that was a rather extraordinary revelation. Regano was with Traficante in his Tampa home when Traficante was not quite, but almost on his deathbed. He was dying, and he wanted to get a few things off his chest, some things that were bothering him. And he turned to Regano at a certain point, and he said, "You know, Frank, Carlos, he blew it. We shouldn't have gotten Giovanni. We should have gotten Bobby instead." Which, of course, is self-explanatory.
Now, Robert Blakey, who was the chief counsel of the House Assassinations Committee in the late 70s, has been actively trying to reopen a congressional investigation based on Regano's testimony. What's the progress there?
Well, I know that Blakey has been in touch with certain senators who are on the Senate Permanent Committee on Investigations, which is chaired by Senator Frank Nunn. The matter has been brought before their attention. that Regano is willing to testify under oath and with grant of immunity, and that's important to him because he could be considered an accessory to the assassination if he brought the message, so to speak, from Hoffa down to Marcello and Trafficante. So if they're willing to give him a grant of immunity, he will testify under oath. He will answer any questions that the senators direct toward him. And is perfectly willing to go through this potentially extremely grueling process. So far, I don't think that Senator Nunn has agreed to call Regano before the committee as a witness. There are lots of political considerations here, as you may well expect in an election year. But it's something that's being pushed by a number of people. I've been in touch with our dear senators in this state, Moynihan and D'Amato, about it. They all know that this man is willing to come forward and tell his story. But so far, I don't think there's been any decisive action on it, Charlie.
Of course, John, Frank Regano is appealing a tax conviction, and he's very sick. Is it possible these Pauls are just waiting for him to slip off his mortal coil just and to, avoid again?
Just to die on us, as so many witnesses have. They may be delaying for that reason. The strange thing is that Congressman Stokes told the Justice Department at the time the Frank Regano allegation broke that they should definitely look into it, and that he as chairman of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, expected them to investigate this allegation, and they haven't done a thing. I heard that an FBI agent visited Frank Regano in Florida, and I met Frank Regano a couple of weeks ago out in California and asked him about it. He said, yeah, there's been a lot of talk about that. He wasn't sent by the Justice Department. He's an old buddy of mine. I've known him for years, and he just came down to chat with me about it. So the Justice Department has done nothing about this allegation, to prove it or disprove it.
Governor Clinton, the Democratic nominee for president, is using a picture of him as a boy shaking hands with President Kennedy as a major part of his campaign. Has there been any effort on the part of yourself or other assassination researchers to hold Clinton's feet to the fire on this issue?
I haven't contacted him. The thought flashed through my mind when I saw that a very emotional Kennedy presentation at the convention, the film, and the speech by Joe Kennedy II, and introducing Ethel Kennedy to the audience, and the whole sort of Kennedy montage that I thought was very effective from an emotional point of view at the convention. And obviously Clinton is trying to emulate the Kennedy style. There's something about his mannerisms, his looks, the way he wears his hair, and it's sort of fluffed up, and he's got big, bright teeth like Kennedy. I think he is trying to emulate Kennedy to a certain extent. And these issues should be brought to his attention very forcefully. And I happen to think that he could add quite a few people to his constituency if he came out and said, and I intend to do something to get to the bottom of the Kennedy assassination.
Certainly, as the baby boom ticket, Clinton and Gore are representing a generation whose history is unknown, from the Kennedy assassination through the King assassination, Watergate, and right up to Iran-Contra. People in their 30s and 40s can argue that we don't know the history of our own lifetime. Has there been any indication in Clinton's career that he's even interested in the JFK and RFK assassinations and who did them?
I have to be honest with you, Charlie. I do not know, and I don't know who has looked into the matter, but I think we should look into it. And you put a bug in my head, and I think I'll look into it.
I think you should, John. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, listener-sponsored radio. This is Art Breaking. I'm Charlie Finch. Glad to have you with us. We're talking with John Davis, author of Kennedy's Dynasty and Disaster, out in paperback from SBI Books. books, and Carlos Marcello and the Assassination of John F. Kennedy in a Signet paperback from New American Library. John, you've also written an introduction to the new book by Robert Crenshaw, the pathologist who examined both John F. Kennedy's body and Lee Harvey Oswald's body. Tell us a bit about Crenshaw's allegations and the efforts in the media like the New York Times to refute them.
I was very struck by Crenshaw's allegation, which he made very forcefully in a recent paperback book, that he inspected Kennedy's wounds very carefully, was the last person to put Kennedy into his coffin, bent over that throat wound, looked at it very attentively, the head wound, and came to the conclusion then that Kennedy had been wounded by two shots from the front, one in the neck, a very small wound, and a massive wound on the right side of the head. And nothing has shaken his conviction, as one of the surgeons at Parkland who treated Kennedy's wounds right after the assassination. Of course, some amazing things he tells in that book, Charlie, have to do with President Johnson. And this revelation really startled me. And incidentally, I regard Crenshaw as an absolutely impeccable witness.
He's a very straight-laced person, and he's been silent all these years.
He's been silent because he thought he might ruin his medical career if he had thrown the bombshell on the Warren Commission that the shots came from the front instead of from behind. The startling revelation that he made, which I guess a lot of people know about by now, was that while he was treating Oswald's wounds, he was summoned to an office in the hospital for a phone call. And the phone call, to his absolute amazement, was from President Lyndon Johnson. And Johnson told him that he wanted a deathbed confession from Oswald. He was very, very firm about it. Get me a deathbed confession from that guy, and there's somebody in the trauma room who would take it. And Crenshaw said he had noticed a very strange individual with a smock on, with a medical smock on, wandering around with a pistol at his side, with no apparent authorization for being there, and no apparent reason for being there. And he realized that the reason why he was there was to take the deathbed confession, possibly even at gunpoint. Well, when Crenshaw got back from the office, he realized that Oswald was gone and there wasn't going to be any deathbed confession. And he told that to the strange individual, and the strange individual abruptly left the operating room. So there's a very perplexing episode. What was Lyndon Johnson up to? Was Lyndon Johnson a conspirator in this plot and was just trying to get off the hook right away with a deathbed confession? I, Lee Harvey Oswald, did this acting alone? Or was Lyndon Johnson simply so obsessed with the notion of a conspiracy of any kind that he wanted some kind of a deathbed confession from Oswald? But Charlie, as you mentioned, the reaction to this allegation was quite varied. The Daily News printed it in absolutely, in all its details. The New York Post did. I don't know what the other papers throughout the nation did, but the New York Times did not breathe a word about it. Didn't even mention it until later they devoted a front page article to the American Medical Association Journal's article on the sudden breaking of silence of the autopsy surgeons at Bethesda, Doctors Hume and Boswald, who had kept silent, according to the Times, for 28 years, and now have come forth to give you the final word that Kennedy was shot twice from behind and there were no shots from the front. This was a low moment for the New York Times and for journalism anywhere, because Humes and Boswell had not waited 28 years to come forth. Humes and Boswell had been interrogated at great length by the House Select Committee on Assassinations in 1978, and the results of that interrogation was published in a report of 1979. There's nothing new about the testimony of Humes and Boswell, but the Times wanted to seize on it at the time to refute Dr. Crenshaw.
In your book, Kennedy's Dynasty and Disaster, John, you indicate some suspicion about CIA and government involvement in a few instances. First is your proof that Lee Harvey Oswald never went to Mexico. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, well, I got that mostly from Edwin Lopez, who was a staff investigator for the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and who was given the specific job of investigating Oswald's supposed trip to New Orleans in late September, early October, 1963. Much has been made of this visit, and immediately after the assassination, it was given a great deal of publicity that Oswald went to the Cuban embassy, went to the Soviet embassy, made a very conspicuous presence there, denouncing his own country, praising Fidel Castro, wanting to get a visa to Cuba, and eventually to return to the Soviet Union. Lopez and other investigators researched every single angle of this visit. They looked over hundreds of CIA surveillance photos of the Cuban embassy and the Soviet embassy, and there wasn't one single photograph that came up with anyone who bore the vaguest likeness to Oswald. They also went over the transcripts of tape-recorded conversations, supposed tape-recorded conversations, of someone representing himself as Oswald with somebody at the Soviet embassy, and they turned out to be highly suspicious also, because Oswald spoke almost fluent and perfectly grammatical Russian, and these transcripts were of someone's Russian that was barely understandable. The actual tapes, he found out, were destroyed by the CIA. So he came to the conclusion that someone representing himself as Lee Harvey Oswald made visits to the Cuban and Soviet embassies in the late fall of 1963 with a deliberate purpose of creating a legend for the assassin to be, creating an image, let us say, for the impending suspect in the assassination, which is exactly what took place, and which gave the impression to millions of people that Oswald was a Marxist and a Castroite and was bent on going to Cuba and eventually the Soviet Union. So this was a very sophisticated ploy by somebody. Somebody got somebody to pose as Lee Harvey Oswald in Mexico City and to more or less lay a trail of evidence against Oswald before the assassination even occurred. Who might have been behind such a sophisticated scheme? It doesn't seem like the kind of thing a mafia boss would cook up. I researched that to some extent and found out that in the entire history of organized crime, there have been examples of imposters who they have mixed up, let's say, in a murder conspiracy, but nothing, never to this very sophisticated length. So it seems that somebody connected to U.S. intelligence or a perhaps low-level rogue element of U.S. intelligence could have been conspiring with the underworld to assassinate the president.
But didn't you, in fact, talk to David Atlee Phillips, the late CIA agent who may have been Maurice Bishop? That was his nom de guerre.
I didn't talk to him, Charlie, but Anthony Summers talked
Anthony
to him.
Summers talked to him, excuse
and,
me.
And Anthony, he's a good friend of mine, and he said that David Adley Phillips, before he died, said that he had finally come to the belief that elements of U.S. intelligence were involved in the conspiracy.
Let's take a short musical break. We'll be back with John Davis soon. Welcome back to Art Breaking. If it's the first weekend in August, it must mean that it's time for the WBAI fundraising brunch at Bernard's French Cuisine this Sunday. There are two sittings, 11:30 and 1 p.m. It costs only $10 plus tip, made by Bernard at his restaurant, host of Food Amour, which you can hear every Wednesday at 1:30. Bernard's French Cuisine is located at 145 Avenue C in the East Village, and it is the top French restaurant in town. For information and reservations, you can call the station at 279-0707. That's this Sunday at 11:30 and 1 o'clock, Bernard's French Cuisine, 145 Avenue C. Next week on Art Breaking, my guest will be Norman Dubrow, foremost collector of drawings in the WBAI books, and also Mafia Kingfish, Carlos Marcello, and The Assassination of John F. Kennedy, a Signet paperback from New American Library. Now, John Davis, Bob Mayhew, who started the whole CIA assassination plots against Fidel Castro in September of 1960, has a new book out about Howard Hughes, and he's been on a kind of puff talk circuit trip. He was on the Joan Rivers show, for example, talking about Howard Hughes. Does Bob Mayhew have anything to say about the Kennedy assassination, and has he been questioned in detail by the various committees?
I don't think he has anything new to say, and as a matter of fact, I was very disappointed with that book. which was published by my publisher, because here he was involved in one of the most disgraceful episodes in American history. That is the plot to assassinate Fidel Castro using members of organized crime, really major bosses, killers from the mafia to accomplish the deed. And he more or less skims over it rather lightly in the book. He doesn't seem to think it's a very terrible thing. He refers to organized crime, when he goes into these plots, as the gambling syndicate people. Doesn't call them mafia or Cosa Nostra. And then he's someone who should have insights into the Kennedy assassination, having participated in those other plots. And he doesn't seem to have any insights into the Kennedy assassination at all. He glosses over it, doesn't go into it in any great detail, and seems to go along with the Warren Commission lone gunman position.
Between 1975 and 1977, Momo Giancana was shot to death in Chicago. Johnny Roselli was found in a drum, dead and hacked to death in Biscayne Bay. Jimmy Hoffa disappeared, never to be heard from again. George de Morenschild, Oswald's mentor and possibly a CIA agent, committed suicide, quote unquote. Who had the power to have done all this, John? Was it Santos Trafficante, Carlos Marcello, the CIA? Any theories on that?
Of course, we're not altogether sure, Charlie, that Sam Giancana was murdered because he was about to testify before the Senate Committee on Intelligence. We're not altogether sure that Roselli was murdered for that reason either. We're not altogether sure that de Morenschild was murdered because he knew something, even though he was murdered the very day he was contacted by the House Select Committee on Assassinations. So we really have to indulge in speculation. If these individuals were murdered because of what they knew about the Kennedy assassination, it could be consistent with a mafia plot, because it's time-honored mafia tradition to wipe out witnesses. It's been going on for 100 years. It's going on probably even as we speak. So it wouldn't be beyond the mafia's capability or intentions to knock off the witnesses. However, when you come to such high-level individuals, and the fact that they were going to appear before governmental, congressional committees, and therefore might also damage elements of the U.S. government, it's certainly within reason that those who were behind those killings could have been CIA people.
Who are some of the other people still living who a hypothetical Senate committee would call? E. Howard Hunt, would he be one? Frank Sturgis? Other Bay of Pigs
operatives?
Yeah,
I think that E. Howard Hunt may be called before such a committee. In regard to the Regano allegation, I have already suggested to some people that Carlos Marcello's brother be called before the committee, because he was Carlos Marcello's right-hand man and his underboss, so to speak, and he was very close to him. And Joseph Marcello is alive and well in New Orleans, along with his other brothers. Carlos Marcello had six brothers. And Carlos Marcello, as we know, is practically out of it, non compos mentis, as they say in Italy. He doesn't recognize members of his family or friends. He apparently has Alzheimer's disease. He suffered several mini-strokes when he was in prison. He was let out. He's now at home and is in very bad shape, especially mentally. So he probably wouldn't be worth anything as a witness. But his brother Joseph, I am convinced, knows something. I had that feeling when I was researching my book in Louisiana. There were people who would say, well, I'm not going to say too much. But I think you go to Joe. You go to Joe. Joe, I think Joe knows something, you know. I was interviewing, you know, people off the street in bars, and this is what they all told me.
Tell us about Tony Marcello being spotted with Lee Harvey Oswald on Airline Highway outside of New Orleans a couple of months before the assassination.
Yeah, Tony Marcello, who was one of Carlos Marcello's brothers, was spotted in the company of Lee Harvey Oswald in the Town and Country Motel, which was Carlos Marcello's headquarters in New Orleans at the time. Tony Marcello was, and there was another allegation by an FBI informant, an allegation that got nowhere because J. Edgar Hoover never turned the allegation over to the Warren Commission, that one day this guy who was working as a bartender in a bar controlled by the Marcello family in New Orleans, he was in the bar one day, and the bar owner was there, and the bar owner's partner, and Tony Marcello came into the bar to service the slot machines, which the Marcello organization kept and maintained in bars in New Orleans. And Tony came in and said, "Well, boys, the word is out. Kenny's going to get shot when he comes south. And there's a plot against Jack Kennedy and other members of the Kennedy family." Well, this guy, this bartender, was hovering in the shadows, overheard this, it horrified him, and he went to the FBI, and he told the whole story, and nothing came of it.
Doesn't it stand to reason that if Marcello and Trafficante had JFK hit, that they would want some assurance from CIA underlings or someone in the government that the prosecution would not be pursued before the assassination, before they would go ahead with it?
Oh, you're absolutely right. And I think they had that insurance. For one thing, I learned while I was researching my book, Mafia Kingfish, that Carlos Marcello had also been one of the participants in the CIA Mafia plot to assassinate Castro. The principal participants were Trafficante and John Connor and Rosselli, all of whom Carlos Marcello knew, and he was also very close to Trafficante. But we did not know that Marcello was involved in those plots. However, an FBI informant found out in 1979 by just getting Marcello into conversations about it that he had also played a role in those plots. So if Marcello had been involved in the CIA plots, he would have been covered by the CIA. In other words, the CIA would not move against him, would do nothing whatsoever to investigate his possible involvement in a plot to kill Kennedy for fear that their darkest secret would come out, the plot to assassinate Castro. This was the secret that the CIA was keeping hold of more than anyone, more than any other in all their operations. So the CIA was compromised, so to speak. It wouldn't have done a thing about Marcello. I also believe that Marcello had the FBI more or less in his pocket also, because there is strong evidence that the FBI was, let's say, protecting Carlos Marcello. J. Edgar Hoover had formed a strange bond, a strange relationship with Frank Costello, the so-called prime minister of the underworld, the New York boss. And Frank Costello was the sponsor of Carlos Marcello and was responsible for his career in New Orleans. We won't go into all those details, but he was very tight with him, very close with him. And Hoover relied greatly on Frank Costello for a number of things, which I go into in the book, but we don't have time here. And I seriously doubt if Hoover would have moved against Marcello, because it would have upset his good friend Frank Costello too much, with God knows what kind of horrendous consequences. There's another factor here, Charlie. Bobby Kennedy had urged Hoover time and time again to intensify his surveillance of Marcello. And for some reason, Hoover had failed. They never got the electronic surveillance on Marcello that they got on the other bosses. The FBI man in New Orleans repeatedly sent messages back that not to worry about Carlos, he's just a tomato salesman, that's all he is. And this irritated Bobby, you know, beyond belief. And so it would have been embarrassing beyond, it would have been so embarrassing if it had turned out that Marcello had anything to do with the assassination. Because Bobby would have told Hoover, for God's sake, look what I told you to get on this guy's case, and now you're responsible for the death of my brother, and that would have been the end of Hoover's career. So I think both the FBI and the CIA would have protected Marcello.
A few days before the assassination of Robert Kennedy in 1968, he gave a speech at a college in California in which he said point blank, only the powers of the presidency will be sufficient to expose the dirty dealing in the agency and the mafia. Do you think the Kennedys basically wanted to, either right before JFK's assassination or during Robert Kennedy's 68 presidential campaign, to ultimately root out the bad seeds within the government and expose them publicly?
I think that was one of Bobby's intentions, because he knew that his brother had been killed as a result of a conspiracy. He confided that to the noted historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. He confided that to a very close political aide, Richard Goodwin. He even told Goodwin, who was also an aide to President Kennedy, that he suspected that Marcello was behind the crime. He also confided that to his former press secretary, Frank Mankiewicz. So we have ample evidence as to who Bobby suspected, but he was impotent to move against him. He couldn't do anything against Marcello as a senator. But if he became president of the United States, then he would have the power to open either a secret investigation or a public one. But I think it always was in the back of his head that he would reopen the investigation himself with the powers of the presidency behind him. And that might have something, this is maybe a cockeyed theory, Charlie, but it is generally believed now that the president's brain and the wound tissue slides, 78 slides of his wounds, which disappeared from the National Archives, were taken by Bobby Kennedy. At least the House Select Committee on Assassinations came to this opinion. And I have the idea that he sequestered these vital evidentiary items so that the FBI wouldn't get their hands on them and destroy them, or the CIA or some other organ of the government wouldn't get a hold of them. And he would be holding this absolutely vital evidence, which he could use in a future investigation.
Now, John Davis, the late Stephen Smith, JFK's brother-in-law and campaign manager, stored most of JFK's personal effects in Manhattan storage, a storage house here in Manhattan, for years and years. Do you think that the Kennedy brain and those slides might be there?
My Lord, that...
Apparently, JFK's rocking chair and robes...
God, that's a new one, Charlie. I never thought of that. We got the idea that Bobby buried that stuff. You know, there was a lot too. There was not only the brain. There were these wound tissue slides. There was other physical specimen evidence that would have been absolutely vital to the reopening of the case. And you think it's in one of those lockers?
It's possible. Maybe someone should check it out.
We should get in touch with Steve Smith's son.
Willie Smith.
Willie Kennedy Smith.
Whose case you talk about in your book, Kennedy's Dynasty and Disaster. John Davis, there are indications that the Kennedy family, which has stuck publicly to the lone assassin theory, because of the Regano allegations, that the kind of crack in the wall is there, and that they might be more amenable to a new investigation. Is that true? Ted Kennedy, Joe Kennedy, Bobby's son, and others?
You know, I think they're open-minded, but they've tended to avoid the issue as much as they possibly could. The family had been more or less told by Bobby Kennedy to accept the lone gunman hypothesis because it was sort of a politically neutral solution to the crime. It wouldn't damage the Kennedys' reputation. Bobby, of course, feared that if it was found out that Marcello was behind the crime, and Bobby had gone after Marcello so ferociously, even to the extent of arguably illegal kidnapping of him and deportation to Guatemala, that the assassination could be blamed on him, that it could have boomeranged on him. So the Kennedys were always very very sensitive to the political implications of research into possible Kennedy assassination conspiracies. But so much time has gone by. I have a feeling that Ted Kennedy is perhaps beyond reclaiming. But young Joe Kennedy II, he's an energetic guy. He is no fool. If he thought it was politically expedient for him, and if he thought that it would do something for the Kennedy family and perhaps for his own political prospects, I think he might very well move on the case.
Do you think there's a fear in the second generation, the young Joe Kennedys, young John Kennedy, young Robert Kennedy, that if they do get involved, their lives might ultimately be in danger as their political careers continue?
I don't see how they could not help but be somewhat fearful, especially if they become extremely visible. I often get the feeling that it's upsetting that young John F. Kennedy Jr. gets so much attention, and that he's become so famous before he's done anything really significant, just because he was JFK's son. And that the fact that he is so visible could touch off a nerve with some nut or idiot who would just like to put a medal on his chest as having gotten rid of the other John F. Kennedy. You know, it's too horrible to contemplate, but those fears must go through their heads. And certainly, if it ever did come to pass that John F. Kennedy Jr. became a candidate for the presidency or President of the United States, that there would be some attempt on his life.
John Davis, you talk about in Kennedy's Dynasty and Disaster about a conference of assassination researchers at Fredonia. Tell us a bit about that and about the general consensus of assassination researchers such as yourself and Robert Groden and others with some credibility about what should be done next. These conferences are a pretty regular thing now, correct?
Yeah, that was a very big conference and a very interesting one, and all points of view were expressed. And at the end, we came to certain conclusions. One conclusion was that Lee Harvey Oswald did not kill President Kennedy acting alone, that if he actually did shoot some of the shots that hit Kennedy, he had Confederates.
For what it's worth, I think he smuggled in the gun but did not fire the shots.
Yeah, I think he gave the gun to somebody else.
I do too.
Who fired the shots. I think the evidence points in that direction. That also there was, in addition to just getting rid of Kennedy, there was a subordinate tangential reason, let us say, for the assassination, and that was to incite the American public to get the government to invade Cuba again, which leads us to believe that the people behind the plot were mafia bosses who wanted to get their casinos back, Cuban exiles who wanted to get their country back, and possibly CIA operatives who were terribly disappointed in Kennedy's Cuban policy. But there is so much evidence that Oswald was made out to be a pro-Castro communist sympathizer. We already discussed already the legend that was created for him in New Orleans. There were many other instances, in Mexico City, but in New Orleans, as we know, he went out and demonstrated for Castro with placards and leaflets. And it turned out, where was he keeping these placards and leaflets? In the office of Guy Bannister, who was a right-wing anti-Castro supporter, who probably put him up to it. So a subordinate purpose of this assassination was to incite the American people against Castro and to compel the government to invade Cuba again. And it is to the credit of the government that they didn't give in to that impulse, I must say.
You also provide in your book new evidence that Jack Ruby was involved in the infamous Secret Service party in Fort Worth the night before JFK's assassination. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there doesn't seem to be much doubt now, because we talked to the son of the nightclub owner in, not really a nightclub, a club owner in Fort Worth, where Secret Servicemen caroused the night before the assassination. They stayed up as late as until 4 o'clock in the morning. These were people who were supposed to be in the presidential detail and in the motorcade. And according to Kirkwood, the son of the owner of the club, the girls who were invited to this bacchanalia were none other than Jack Ruby's strippers. And they were the ones who were plying the Secret Service agents with drink, one after another, and all over them, as you can well expect, indicating a possible other dimension to the conspiracy on the part of Jack Ruby.
Finally, John Davis, do you think that a group of assassination researchers such as yourself, Robert Groden, and others will actually approach Clinton in the next few weeks, as we've discussed on this show?
I'm going to call up Bob Groden and tell him to go ahead and try. I don't know the guy. I don't have any contacts with Clinton. I don't have any personal pipeline to him, but I think you've put your finger on something.
Frank Greer, who handles communications for him, was involved in the really radical side of the Democratic Party with Senator Fred Harris and others during the 70s. He might be someone you could approach.
Give me his name after we break up here. We'll find a way to do it.
Well, John Davis, I'd like to thank you for being my guest today on Art Breaking. We look forward to your next visit.
It was great, Charlie.
We could go on for hours about this.
We could.
But it does seem, you know, that the Stone movie has really said we've got to put our feet to the fire and get some facts and get some answers, I think.
Yeah, finally. The Stone movie did heighten the consciousness of the people to this crime. I'm not endorsing its conclusions. I'm basically against its ultimate conclusions. But it did have an immense effect on raising consciousness.
Again, John Davis's books, which you can get in paperback, are Kennedy's Dynasty and Disaster from SBI Press and Mafia Kingfish, a reissue, Carlos Marcello and the Assassination of JFK, a reissue from Signet paperbacks from New American Library. Thanks again, John Davis. Thank you, Matthew Finch, for bringing the show from the board. And let's fade out with the Rolling Stones.
That was great, Charlie.